to the brothers and sisters of the Black Cloak Society. I am sure you all have questions about this mysterious voice speaking to you in dreams. It is the voice of our mighty leader, who is now preparing to walk among us once more.
1,000 years ago, there existed a dark cult of the worst and most evil wizards in the world. The Silver Cloak Society was formed by some of the wisest and most noble wizards, the perfect antithesis to the Black Cloaks.
I haven't managed to find a way to stop evil from reaching my family.
King Graham, you must come with me immediately.
What's wrong?
Sire, it's your wife.
Nisa.
You surely understand we cannot live in a world without evil. All things must exist in a perfect balance.
Your whole family is being called by the echoes of the prophecy to play a part in the final chapter of this story. Yourself, King Graham.
Welcome, listeners. It's Traherne here with the Solar Sendcast and a long-awaited legitimate entry into our King's Quest series of posts, The Silver Air of Eternity Goes Yonder Omnibus. I'm happy to have three of the game developers from the newest installment, Phoenix Online Studios' King's Quest The Silver Lining. On the panel tonight is Public Relations Manager and Co-Designer Katie Hallahan. How are you doing today, Katie?
Hi, good. How are you?
Nice to meet you. Art Director and Co-Director of the Silver Lining computer game, Richard Flores.
Hi.
How you doing,
Pleasure.
Richard? Thank
good.
You. You too. And the CEO of Phoenix Online Studios and the designer and director of King's Quest The Silver Lining, Cesar Bitar. How are you doing, Cesar?
Hey. I'm doing great. How are you?
Great to meet all you guys. I wanted to start out a little bit kind of getting to know you guys. So, Katie, what was your first experience with the King's Quest franchise? Like, what was the first game you played, and how did it affect you?
Let's see. I can never actually remember if it was 3 or 4 that I played first, but I know I remember we had them both around the same time when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Their games I definitely liked right away. I liked the whole, you know, playing with fairy tales aspect, and definitely with 4, I really liked that there was a girl that you got to play.
Right, 4 is the Perils of Rosella, I believe.
Right.
Yeah, that a lot of, you know, that was kind of the old, like, text. You still had to text in the commands as opposed to the point and click, which everyone's kind of familiar with nowadays.
Yep.
So did you just play that at school and you got kind of addicted to the whole series?
Well, we had them at my house, actually. My family had those. But yeah, pretty much, I played those, got pretty addicted, and then our computer fell very much behind the times, but then when we finally got a new one, and all of a sudden I realized, oh my god, there are all these other games I can play that Sierra did, so.
The old CD-ROM.
Yeah. We had a CD drive. It was very exciting times.
Nice. How about you, Richard?
I started playing King's Quest with the very first one. I used to sometimes accompany my dad to his work, and while he was off doing his stuff, he'd sit me down at one of his computers at work and, you know, would give me a game to play. And one day he just gave me this new King's Quest game to try out. And for like the entire afternoon, I was mesmerized by this game just because it was the first time that you could actually walk around an entire world, explore it, where you actually had to map it out and, you know, figure out all these little puzzles to keep progressing. And it was fun. Something I actually got to play with my dad and my sister for at least the first 4 or 5 games. So for me, I have very fond memories of that. It was a family bonding game for us. So
great. Yeah, you can really tell from the game that this kind of, I mean, obviously it's a labor of love, but you know that you can tell there's like deep rooted sentiments towards the original game. So you see that a lot, which is really awesome. How about you, Cesar?
Well, I played King's Quest 3 for like an afternoon when I was a kid. And then I didn't touch King's Quest actually until I was a teenager. when I got King's Quest VI. I remember that I got a bunch of games, and King's Quest was one of them. I told myself, okay, I'm going to get a King's Quest because it's about time that I play this series. And I got King's Quest VI, and I tried it. It was the first one of the bunch that I tried, and I was just completely mesmerized by the game, too. I couldn't stop playing it. It became a classic right away for me.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And then, you know, after that, I just went back and I started playing all the other games.
Yeah, that's really similar to how I got into the series, too. I got in, like, a bag of free games, and it came with our computer, and it was one of the best things I ever played, and it really affected, like, how I read and how I use vocabulary and how I draw and create characters. It really was like a basis for my creative outlet. So it's really awesome to talk to somebody who kind of feels the same way.
Yeah.
Well, I think a lot of us learned to read and write with those old adventure games, to be honest. I don't think my vocabulary would be quite as good today if I hadn't had to like figure out what this four by four pixel thing on the screen was supposed to be, and
yeah.
Go to the dictionary and try to find the proper word and all that stuff. So,
well, yeah. I learned English thanks to those games.
Oh, great. Awesome.
In fact, I think my little niece, when she gets just a little bit older, I'm going to make her play those games just to get her to start that whole concept of reading and writing and all that stuff.
Yeah,
you know, before she gets too old to go, man, these graphics are outdated and suck. You know?
Right.
But she's still young enough to be like impressed by it. I think I'm going to try to get her to play through them just to.
Yeah, it sounds like a good homeschool curriculum. Just King's Quest games.
There you go.
CR
games in general.
What's that?
CR games in general are an excellent curriculum.
Yeah, they have a large library.
Well, as long as it's not Larry.
Yeah.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Well, you got to expose the kids sooner or later. So you might
a different curriculum there.
Leisure Suit Larry, 1 through 5. Let's talk about the project a little bit. Now, I've been keeping up with it since, like, I think 2002. So it's been a long ride for people that are interested in King's Quest and, like, waiting for this game. And I'm sure it's even been a longer experience and possibly a hurdle for you guys trying to get it up off the ground, trying to get it, you know, past all the legal problems, which we'll talk about a little bit, hopefully, in a second. But how did you guys organize this company, the studio, and start a project like this, a project that is massive, like The Silver Lining? Richard, why don't we talk to you?
Well, actually, you probably want to ask Cesar that question, to be honest, because he's really he was a turning point in the project, because neither me or Cezzy actually started this project. It was Jonathan Haling and Luke Jensen that were really the founders of this project.
Okay.
But around 2002, they decided to leave the project and go do other things. So it kind of fell in the lap of Cezzy, who then brought me on as art director, and we basically rebooted the project from there.
Can I call you Cezzy, Cesar?
Sure.
Cezzy, how from your experience, how did you get the project off the ground? Give us a little background.
Well, I kept wanting to do something with this project because for a year nothing was happening. I mean, we had ideas, and every month or every 2 months somebody would send like an environment or a piece of music,
mm-hmm.
and I really, really wanted to, you know, to really start working on it. And I kept bugging Jonathan Haling for, you know, let's do something, let's push it, let's move it, let's make it happen. So like Richard said, around 2002 he stepped down and he left me the project, and at that point I started to think about, you know, so what do we need to get this project on and going. So I started to divide the team into like different departments. And I tried, you know, at that time I was really inexperienced, but I tried to start working with, you know, some kind of schedules. We tried to start putting like the website up to bring more people in. And that's basically, I mean, from that point, we, you know, it was a learning experience for all of us. And as we went, we started to try different things. You know, at one point we had like a whole groups that we use for, you know, internal communication and uploading files and having schedules posted for people. And you know, we've gone through the years trying all these different methods and these different things that you know, some have stayed, some have changed, some are completely new, as to how we manage the whole project and you know, make games.
Yeah, because like kind of the landscape of computer games and video games in general changed so dramatically between from what it hears from when you tried to start this project till today. So yeah. Were you constantly trying to like update things and keep up, or were you trying to like, did you set a plan and say, okay, we got to finish this now, or we got to finish this with
no.
This?
No, we actually, I think that's one of the reasons the project kind of took a bit longer than expected was we, you know, when the game first started, it was going to be this 2D game, and then I brought in the idea maybe we could do it a pseudo 3D way where we don't build a full set, but we try to use 3D to make it a bit more cinematic, and then Sezzy pushed it even further to a point where we had to kind of redesign some of the sets because he wanted to see this angle and this angle and this angle. And
okay.
Fortunately, when you moved the camera there, you saw a big hole in the set. So there was always there's this big learning process that we've been kind of going through to make. So the game that we had like even like 5 years ago when we put out a first prototype demo looks nothing like the current game. Like there's been a significant leap forward. I wouldn't say it looks next gen because we're still like limited by the engine that we picked at the time. But
right.
You know, there's definitely tricks that we've learned progressively over the past 10 years to make this game better and better. So, and that, I think that's definitely a reason why the project has taken 10 years is we're never happy with what we do. So we keep trying to push the envelope. And when we do, then the rest of the game kind of looks a little bit worse. So we kind of have to bring that up. So it's been a lot of give and take to make this game the way it is.
The good thing about this is that we've become a lot faster at what we do, and now we have a lot more experience in how to put things together. We recently put a project together that, you know, in the past would have taken us about a year to put together, and we put it together in like 2 months. So,
oh, awesome.
Yeah. So it really has taught us how to deal with things, it's put it in a place where we're comfortable with how we're working. And I mean, you know, as we go, we're still learning and we're still trying to make the pipelines work better and faster and optimize everything. But I think that, you know, right now we're at a point where, okay, so what's the next step for us? We're going to go commercial and we're ready for it.
Yeah. You guys are learning and aptly managing a company from the, you know, the ground up, basically.
Pretty much.
Katie, PR manager, does that mean you dealt with a lot of the legal issues that have been going or had gone on previously? I know there was an issue with Vivendi Studios, am I correct? And then Activision.
With Activision later on. We've pretty much like all the directors have kind of been in on dealing with the various legal issues. And actually my role, like, you know, PR thing with PR direction was sort of something that came up more recently as we started gearing up for the final release.
Okay.
As far as that, but we've all been involved in that and kind of, you know, being in contact with Vivendi and then Activision and trying to figure out a way, you know, to make everything work basically for both their company and for what we wanted to do with the game.
Yeah, because the background was is like they didn't really kind of want this project to come up because weren't they planning on using the King's Quest franchise in some way, but then decided not to, and letters were exchanged.
Yeah, I don't know about anything official. I think like there's like a picture from a supposed King's Quest 9 prototype developed by Sierra like way back in like 2000 or something, maybe.
Yeah. I think it was from 2002.
Yeah, 2002 then maybe. But it's like one picture of a character and I don't even know who's
like,
supposed
one
to be
like Zelda project.
Yeah, no, it looked like Zelda.
Yeah, it looked nothing like King's Quest. I mean, ultimately, what it just came down to is a big corporation seeing that they own something and not knowing enough about the project and just sicking their lawyers on you without really, you know, exploring what it was all about. And that's kind of why we got the stuff reversed most of the time is because once they sent us the legal notification, and then we kind of pulled back and then actually opened a dialogue with them. And then usually once they found out what the project was about, they were like, oh, okay, it's not this is not as big of a deal as we thought. I'm not sure we can
steal your money.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
Exactly. Plus, you guys got some massive free hype for the game.
That did work a little in our favor, yeah.
any other things you want to say about like the build up and the beginnings of the project? Anything that you want the listeners to kind of hear? Any interesting stories?
I mean, it was you know, at that point we were really, you know, we didn't know what we were gonna be doing. We wrote a script that was
huge,
1500 yeah. page of
wow.
Yeah, it was 9 full chapters from
wow.
you know, at the end the 5 episodes, it's 3 of those chapters. There were 6 more chapters beyond that.
Oh wow.
Yeah,
we just didn't know what we were getting into. We had no idea, absolutely no idea about what we wanted to do. It just seemed reasonable. I kept writing and adding scenes and characters, and I was so proud to have, we have 400 characters in this game. You tell me that today, and I tell you, you're crazy.
That's
an experience. So, you know, you're like, we're going to make the greatest, biggest game ever, you know, to even make Final Fantasy blush. You know, we had that great idea in our heads, and then when it came time to put it together, you're like, yeah, we can't do this.
That's why no one else does this.
talking about the story, how much, like, I want to know kind of like where you were getting your ideas from. Were you trying to tie up loose ends with the original games and, you know, Mask of Eternity, everybody kind of points fingers that it wasn't a great sequel to the franchise, it wasn't a good finale to the franchise. How much of the story, the 1500 page story that you guys have penned, was it tying up loose ends, or were you guys trying to start something new, start to expand the mythology of King's Quest?
I'd definitely say we did a little of both.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I feel like the original idea was definitely to tie up loose ends, but I think very much in the process of that we added some expansions to the
mythology. We got excited.
Yeah, exactly. Get an idea in your head and then all of a sudden just kind of run away with it. But and some of that, and you can definitely still see, I think, both of it in the game that we have now.
Oh yeah, definitely. It's massive game. Like just playing in it and listening to the characters speak, it's like there's so much behind this dialogue that, you know, that it does need like 10 chapters or 20 chapters of games. Now, is it true that it was supposed to take an exorbitant amount of time to actually finish the entire script, I guess, that you guys are talking about, and you're saying that only the 5 episodes you guys are planning is only the 3 chapters of the script?
Yeah, and I mean, honestly, you know, if we had the time or the resources to put that whole scene together, it would have dragged way too long.
Okay,
and that's definitely a script that should have been like at least 2 different games.
Okay.
It just went on and on and on and on and at times. And I think that what we did when we turned it into episodes was like we really took the best elements of the story, and you know we just center on those and made it as good as we could. And you know we still have like long conversations with people because we wanted to this at the end of the day this was. This is a game for fans. This is a game made by fans for fans. So we wanted to, you know, even if I've heard people that complain, you know, you talk about to Kasima about things that do not matter to the game. But, you know, when I was writing that, I wanted people to spend time with the characters that they've learned to love over the years, and I wanted them to know them, and I wanted them to, you know, get into that window of a world that maybe we didn't see in past games that much. So, you know, it definitely at points it feels like a story, you know, it's very fan service, it's very fan fiction, but that's exactly what it is. It was meant to be that. Mm-hmm. And we did that within the most professional way that we could find to do it. But it still has that amateur feeling to it, that because essentially that's what it is. It was a learning process for all of us. You know, a lot of people ask me, so how would you do a commercial King's Quest? And if that was the case, it would probably be completely different to the Silver Lining. In the approach and the way that it was written out and everything. But this was a dream of a fan. of King's Quest, basically.
Yeah, I think you guys definitely have a great fan base. Yeah, if you tried to push a game like this now, you know, it'd probably look very similar to, again, like the Mask of Eternity, what they tried to do with that one, I would think. But Richard, let's talk about art. You were talking about 3D a little earlier. You guys chose, you had, I guess, originally a two-dimensionally based game, but then you're like, oh, let's bump it up to 3D. How long does a process like that take? And with the 3D animation, but also with kind of those painted backgrounds and those beautiful backgrounds that we saw in the original games and that we see, of course, in the Silver Lining. Any experience or stories from that end?
Well, I think one thing we learned is we kind of did the work twice. Because we basically did the entire work in 2D, just coming up with the concept art, and we would basically get the sketch, and then we'd say, well, let's color and paint it and figure out what it's going to look like before mm-hmm. we do the 3D version, because it's easier to do on 2D. But it's funny, because ultimately, we ended up with a 3D version and a 2D version, like a complete 2D version of the same sets. So it's almost like, in a sense, like we could have made this game in 2D, because we have all the elements to do. Like all the background elements for it and so forth. So
right.
In a sense, you know, I think especially early on when we were doing a lot of redundant stuff, now we've streamlined our pipeline a bit more and we spend more time focusing on specific design elements that require it. And we don't necessarily do every background and color and so forth just because we feel everything has to be done that way. So I think there was a lot of like little stumbling blocks and things that we were doing the hard way the first time. Like, there's 40 or 50, if not more, characters in TSL. And to be honest, we made every one of those characters unique, you know, different model, different rig, different everything. And now, if we were to look at it nowadays, we'd be like, well, why don't we just make 10 characters and then vary, like, and use them as a base for all the other stuff so we could right. save a lot of work. So, actually, the day we finished all the characters for the game was like an epic milestone for us. We were sure. like, wow, we finally, this is over. You know, we still had a bunch of backgrounds and things to do, but we had actually gone through the entire list of 50 characters and they were all ready to go. And I was like, wow, I never thought this day would come.
That's awesome. Now, take us briefly, like, let's take like a cutscene maybe of the final product. How long, or what goes into like a cutscene, and how long does it take to render, to finalize, stuff like that?
Well, if we talk about the intro, for okay. example, which is the biggest cutscene in the whole game, and it was one of the rendered ones, that took a long while. That actually has been in production since 2004, probably, when we started doing storyboards for it. And you know, after that, we started doing the animatics, which is basically just putting the models in the scene and just blocking out the cameras and where the characters are positioned and all that. And then from there, you know, we start to refine it. We start to actually start to animate it. And then, you know, all the passes through animations. And this was, of course, this was a stop and start process. We didn't work on it, you know, since 2004. We used to work like on a chunk of it and then leave it for a while and then come back to it. The last time that we worked on that was in 2009, Rich. It was, I think, Richard and Michael, who are the two art directors of the game, they just locked up in Michael's house and worked for a complete month.
Yeah, it took us about a month to to go over the entire sequence, refine the animations, render out all that stuff. And it's actually interesting because me and Cezzy, we've had this ongoing argument for the past 10 years about in-game versus pre-rendered stuff and how, you know, when too much stuff is pre-rendered, it takes you out of the game. And I think we both flip-flop on our opinions of it, like, a bunch of times. So we ended up, like, nowadays, like, I think there's only, like, two rendered or maybe three rendered sequences in the entire Silver Lining. The rest is now we try to do it in-game to try to save ourselves the whole problem of rendering. And I find doing stuff in-game is a little bit more forgiving than doing it in a pre-rendered fashion, because I find people tend to, when it's a pre-rendered movie, they seem to expect a lot more than they do from in-game. Like, they don't seem to worry so much when characters go into themselves or there's like a little bit of penetration in different places.
I may not have the critical eye, but it both in-game and cutscenes, they look really great. And that was one of my other points I want to make, was like kind of the environmental effects. You guys have shadows and secondary shadows and, you know, the drops that the rain makes on the ground, just like these really small details that makes this game all kind of very,
actually all Richard. That's thanks to Richard.
Oh, okay.
If he hadn't pushed for all of that, we would probably not have any of that.
One of the small points I noticed was there was a scene where, I think it was the beginning of episode 3, where Graham walks into Cosima's bedroom, and you can see Cosima's reflection in the mirror,
mm-hmm.
like, very briefly. I was just like, wow, I noticed that. Check it out. It was just little things like that that kind of, you know, make me laugh and enjoy it more. Can you tell us a little bit about the music? Who's behind the music, and what did you guys take from that?
That would be Austin Haynes. He's actually probably one of my favorite composers out there. I've worked with him through the whole game to make the music with him. I sit down with him, and this is a process. This is one of the processes that I enjoy most about working on it, on this game, is working with Austin on the music. Basically, I just sit down with him and I tell him, okay, so we need this, this, and this, and then, like, this theme, for example, Chadrak's theme is about this guy, and I tell him, basically, I tell him all the story, the origin of that character, what the theme is supposed to evoke. I give him examples, because I'm a music freak, so especially video games music, I collect soundtracks from every game and every movie out there, so I give him examples of what I want to hear, how I want it to be, and then he goes, he makes his magic, and then he comes back to me, and then we, you know, if I like it, or there are things to fix, I tell him that, I give him feedback until we get something that is nice. For example, the intro music, that was one of the most difficult ones to make, because, you know, it was ups and downs, it was, the music carried the whole intro. Mm-hmm. And that's the way that I envisioned it. That's the way that I wanted. We actually pushed the sound effects down to keep the music up, because the intro was to be a tribute to the old games where there was no voices. It was all silent. And it was also a little bit Final Fantasy 80, you know, Final Fantasy 8-ish.
Yes.
Because that's what I wanted, that's what I envisioned with that, and you know, the past King's Quest where you didn't hear any voice over. So the music for that was really difficult, because we kept going back and forth, and I kept asking, you know, Austin to make it more epic and louder and more bombastic, but at the end it's one of the most beautiful pieces in the game.
Yeah, you want the music, especially in video games, to evoke certain emotions if something's going on screen. I agree. The music does a great job of doing that.
Yeah, Austin is excellent at that, especially at the subtle themes, at the subtle moments. He's magical for that.
It's actually interesting, though, because, I mean, it's very rare on a project that you have somebody who's writing music as an ongoing thing for a project for... How long has Austin been doing this? Like, 6 years?
6 years.
Wow.
So, you know, most times on a project like this or a movie... You know, you wrap it up and then you send it to the sound guy and he'll write the music based on the final cut. Whereas Austin's been more involved from the get-go. You know, even when we were coming up with the character, the characters, he would come up with a musical theme for them right off the bat, you know, and all that stuff. So he's one of the pillars of this project, and the music in this project really shines, I think, because of that.
Yeah, another diehard fan making the game.
Actually, he's not a fan.
Really?
No.
Yep, he's not a fan. He never really played King's Quest games. He just joined because he saw the project, he saw the screenshots and stuff, and he liked it.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So, I mean, back to what Richard was saying, I do think that, you know, this has been, we've taken our time to make this project, and we've really enjoyed making this project, because when you do a commercial game, you don't have the luxury of the many things that we had by making The Silver Lining in a way that we took our time to make, you know, to make sure that everything was exactly how we wanted it to be. You know, when you're pressured by time, you don't get that joy, you know, that long process of pre-production that we had,
mm-hmm.
That we really, really enjoyed, and you know, we went through everything a lot of times until we got it perfect how we wanted it to be. And the same happened with the music, you know, and that was a joy in itself that, you know, I've worked on commercial products and, you know, I used to work with Telltale and Activision, and that kind of elongated time, that doesn't happen, so that you can sit down and really, really see what you have in front of you and really make it great. That luxury doesn't happen when you're doing something commercial. So I think that it was a blessing for us in a way to have that time to do our first project and enjoy it truly.
Did you guys document any behind the scenes videos or anything like that? With the making of something?
Making of. We have a making of somewhere.
Okay. Yeah, we're due to make a new one, though. That one is slightly outdated and primitive. Assembled.
Yeah, that's on our YouTube channel, actually.
Okay, so they can find it.
PO Studios username. And there's, yeah, the making of, which was actually one of the videos that some of the people on the team put together when we had the first shutdown by Vivendi to kind of show them more of what the project was about and convince them to let us go ahead and make the game after all.
Oh, that was what you had, well, that's what you used to convince them?
Among other things, yeah.
Well, it was that and a whole lot of fans writing to them and calling them.
Oh, yeah, I remember signing my name on that the petition or whatever you guys had. More about the game.
About that, but yeah.
What's that, Katie?
I think Cesar has some fun stories about like the when he finally talked to some of the guys on the phone. And they were like, "Would you please tell the fans to stop? It's overwhelming."
Yep.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
A little bit more about the game. I've had some difficulty with the puzzles, which. You know, I didn't write the game, so I don't know what's going on. How, like, I think to myself, you know, it would be fairly difficult to think of puzzles, to solve puzzles and then figure out a way to set them up in a game so that other people can solve them. Is making puzzles for the game a difficult aspect of making the story work?
It is. I sometimes can spend, like, 3 or 4 days thinking of a puzzle and, like, a whole afternoon, you know, just setting it up, and we did that recently with a couple of puzzles for episode 5, where I take my time, you know, in the back of my head while working on other stuff to think about some of the puzzles that I want to have and how I wanted to make them interesting and challenging to a player, and then, you know, finally I spent like a whole afternoon putting them together, and then I sent it to the team for, you know, some kind of play testing to see if people can solve it or if they have problems with it and where do they have problems with it. But it's not easy to make puzzles for a game. On King's Quest, actually, it's easier than in other genres. When you're working with something like sci-fi or something more realistic, it's actually harder to come up with puzzles because, you know, the whimsical aspect of King's Quest gives you a lot more freedom about what you can do.
Yeah,
but right. In general, it's not easy to come up with good puzzles that keep people engaged.
Right, you can't just have violent ends to the character every time he tries to solve a puzzle as you would in some other type of action game.
Yeah,
but adventure games are interesting because characters have these incredibly huge pockets that can carry around things that would never, ever be able to carry with you.
Right.
And we have a couple of examples of that in TSL, especially in episodes 4 and 5, where you're like, wait a second, where are you putting that? I have no idea.
I was laughing in episode 3 where he took like the 2.5 foot by 2.5 foot like tile.
The tile, yeah.
And right, he just goes, bloop, places it in his pocket.
Yeah. I kind of like how he just picks it up and then it's just assumed he fits it.
Yeah, he kind of looks at it for a second and he's like, yeah, this is going to fit.
Yeah, this is no problem. I've carried bigger things out of my pocket before.
Yeah, exactly.
But the cartoony aspect lends itself to that, because like I was watching recently a playthrough of Gabriel Knight 2, which is a live-action version of Gabriel Knight. And
yeah, written by
every
James
time they had to hide something, like put like at one point he grabs this huge piece of rope and puts it in his pocket, and it just looks so weird to see them just stuff things under their jackets, and then mysteriously it's gone. So the cartoony aspect of King's Quest actually allows for that a little bit more, and you're just like, oh, okay, yeah, I can accept that.
Yeah, you can just look past that.
But don't worry, he'll be stuffing a lot more things in his pockets in the next few episodes.
Hopefully he doesn't start carrying the fairy around or something.
No promises. No promises.
Okay, all right. I'm going to look forward to that. I'm holding you to that.
It folds up nicely, see, so.
It's the reassembly that's the problem.
Yeah, that's what really takes a while.
Anything else about the game you guys want to bring up? I've got my questions answered. Anything you guys want to say about the game? I know episode 4 is coming out. Let's talk about that in a second. But the games that are out now, anything more you want to tell about development?
Well, I think one thing going back to the puzzles that we've learned as we've gone through is episodes 1 and 2, we made the puzzles way too easy. Mm-hmm. And I think there's always that give and take on how difficult to make a game because, you know, you don't want the player to get stuck too much, especially nowadays in present day games or games like TSL that have are very story centric. You don't want people to get stuck for 2 weeks at a time. Though me personally, I find that's great. That's what I like about adventure games is the challenge. Right. So, but what we've actually discovered is a lot of fans do want that to a certain degree. They want to have, if they get through a game in 2 hours, they're like, this is not a game. This is just an interactive movie. So, you know, for episode 3, we actually went back to the drawing board in a sense and took all the puzzles and reworked them to, and ultimately I think 3 is our best episode for puzzles. It's challenging enough that you don't finish the game immediately, but it's not impossible to finish. So,
I think episode 3 is our best episode in many, many ways.
It's very suspenseful at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a shame.
The story really picks up in episode 3, and you know, the puzzles are great, I think, and it was a little beast that we put together in a time that I never saw that we would be able to put something like that together. Right. So that is awesome. There is so much new content on episode 3.
Go ahead, Katie.
I was gonna say that has been another advantage of our process. That's definitely an advantage over, you know, having like the time restrictions and the budget restrictions and so forth, is that we get that fan feedback from the first few episodes. We're like, all right, so, you know, episode 3, let's take another look at these puzzles and what kind of stuff can we add? What's going to, you know, really annoy people? Like, and now we know because we've gotten that feedback and be like, all right, this one here is a terrible idea. Let's change it to do this instead.
That's interesting. You guys are developing the game as the game's coming out. I really think that's an awesome aspect. You guys can go back and rework things that didn't work. And
it is awesome. It is awesome to get that kind of feedback from people. I mean, when we released episode 1, we knew that it was short. We knew that it had no puzzles.
Mm-hmm.
But we saw that, you know, people were going to be a little bit, go easier on us because of, you know, episode 2 will come out like soon and, you know. Right. It was only the first episode, and found out that no, that wasn't the case. People wanted the game, and they wanted more than what we gave them at that time. And, you know, I mean, we were aware that it was short, and we were aware that it had no puzzles, but it was a presentation, it was a prologue. And we didn't want to extend the timeline more for release. We'd rather just release that and then work on episode 2. You know, and we found that in general, working on episodes has given us, a better production, you know, production-wise has given us a better timeline just because we can just put one full episode behind and not have to come back to it, not have to worry about it anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you guys gave a great kind of a tagline for episode 1 where it was like a reintroduction to the world, like to the land of the Green Isles, to these characters because, you know, fans haven't seen them in action for, you know, whatever, 12 years. Again, Mask of Eternity doesn't really include any of the main characters, but yeah, it was like a reintroduction to the point and click format, to the land that this story's taking place in, to the characters, and it didn't have any puzzles, but it was still, you know, a nice little look into what we have to look forward to.
Right. Well, that was the whole point of the opening shot of the intro of TSL, where you're flying through the clouds and coming to the Green Isles. It really was designed in a way to feel like you're going back to somewhere familiar. You're just like getting a glimpse of, oh, I know this place. Oh my God, it's the castle. And
right.
we kind of redid the fly through of the castle, because originally it was 3-4 separate shots that led to the garden and the wedding. And then we were like, Well, hang on a second. I took a step back and we tried to re-edit it so it was like one continuous shot where you kind of felt like you were flying through the whole castle, and it actually worked out pretty well. I was actually happy with that opening shot. So
yeah.
And also remember that, you know, this game was not written to be episode-based. It was written to be a full story. So what was chapter one in 9 chapters, it was just a prologue to the story that would have wrapped in the next 8 chapters, which was going to be a full game. So when we divided into episodes, chapter one became a very easy episode one. You know, it fit naturally into being an episode one because of, you know, how it began and how it stopped. And we thought that, you know, at the time we thought, okay, so this is going to be great and this is going to work. But yeah, there was a challenge into making this game episodic because it wasn't meant to be one. And it was, you know, one of my crazy ideas.
It does leave the gamers hanging, I'll give you that much. Yeah. Talking about new episodes, episode 4, is it coming out soon? What can you tell us to kind of pump up the listeners, pump up the fans?
We don't have a release date on it just yet, but okay. We were talking earlier, seeing like, all right, what can we say about it to kind of get people a little more interested in everything? And we're actually with episode 4, we're kind of going into some more story about Pandora's Box, actually.
Oh.
From back
throwback.
In, yes, from back in the Perils of Rosella. And you find out a little bit more story about that.
Are we going to be traveling, perhaps?
It's hard to see some new places you haven't seen. It still takes place in the Green Isles, but I will say this is the last episode that takes place in the Green Isles.
Yeah, so it's the last episode that takes place in the Green Isles.
By the end of this episode, you will be leaving the Green Isles for good.
Yeah.
Oh no.
So you get to revisit like the final Isles from King's Quest VI, where you haven't been to. So the Isle of Beast will be one of the main Isles that you visit in this episode, and we expand the Isle of the Sacred Mountain, so you'll be able to visit more of that as well.
Continue. I'm sorry.
This episode is actually gonna feel like how we originally planned it. The full game open up to you, and you know different things are gonna be happening in different places. It's gonna be an exciting episode. We go also a little bit into more Valenice's story, and you know what her destiny is to be, that kind of stuff. And I think that you know there are a few surprises towards the end of the episode that people are gonna be happy to see as well.
All right, that's exactly the build up I wanted
for the final episode. So
great. Oh, I'm excited now. I gotta play through these games again. One concluding question, I guess, my last question. If you guys, well, this is more of like a futuristic question. You guys have Phoenix Online Studios up and ready to go. What are your plans? What are your future plans? What are your future dreams with this company? What do you guys want to do? After, of course, the Silver Lining comes out and is completed and everybody loves it.
Why not continue to make awesome games?
All right.
We basically want to make games that we want to play. You know, we're going to let the big guys make the big, big, big epic games, and we're going to try to – our goal is to try to bring back the adventure game genre. We know there's a market there. You know, it's not a – we're not going to make $20 million by selling a game, but, you know, if we can make a game and – make a decent profit so we can pay the bills and pay the people that are involved. Yeah. That's ultimately our end goal for this, is to be able to set up a company where we can, you know, make enough money to live and make the games that we loved as kids, basically, and bring them back. So
great. So you guys are still working full-time on the Silver Lining, or you guys have a little side projects going on or anything?
We have a few side projects going on, and we're trying to look past TSL, because I mean TSL episode 4 is on the verge of wrapping up in the next month or two, and then we want to finish episode 5 ideally by the end of the year, so that we can put this whole TSL epic story behind us and work towards the future. So we're in the process of trying to get some stuff off the ground. We went to E3. We talked to some people. We'll see how things pan out to this point.
I mean, we have a bunch of exciting stuff in the horizon, and right now we're just waiting for deals to you know, get concrete and up and running. But definitely, we have some very exciting news that hopefully will materialize, and we will be able to tell everybody about them.
Excellent. Another cliffhanger, says he.
Yeah.
Yep. We're good at those.
We also have a sort of a different format, but another kind of throwback game called Infiltrator that we recently sort of soft announced that would be coming out sometime in the near future. And that's like a top-down shooter, you know, space. You get your spaceship, you're going around shooting up bad guys and that sort of thing.
Okay. Yeah, I did hear some hints.
Something different, but, you know, another thing we're trying out and putting out there. And also we'll have some more news about that coming out sometime soon. So.
Excellent. So look forward to that. Any other concluding thoughts you guys have? Katie?
It's been an extremely interesting ride. And definitely, as always, we have to thank the fans who helped get us here, because really, like, this game would not have finally come out and come to be without their help and their support after, you know, so, like, 8 years of being in development. So
yeah,
huge shout out to them, as always.
Nice. Is there something you'd like to plug? Do you have a site that fans can contact you or see what you're doing with the game, or updates of any kind?
Well, there's the game site, which is tsl-game.com,
right.
Which has all the TSL information. And then we have our Phoenix Online website, which is postudios.com. And we have our forums there. We have a blog there. It has links to our Facebook and our Twitter accounts. So that's the place to go if you want to get all the latest news, really.
All right, great. Richard, anything you want to plug or promote or anything?
No, but I mean, I think we have had, like Katie said, an interesting journey. And it's a very, this group that it came together. And, you know, when we all got together, we didn't really think we would necessarily turn into some sort of commercial game company thing. It was really just a hobby to try to make a game in the spirit of the series we loved. And over the past 10 years, it's been a great learning experience. So now we're on the verge of doing something new. So for me, I've just enjoyed the ride, to be honest. And like I say, it's a very unique way of a company coming into existence. Something, you know, that other companies don't necessarily have. So I like that.
Yeah, definitely. And just like on tsl-game.com, they can find stuff about Richard Flores there, I'm sure.
Well, I'm sure my name is mentioned there, at least in one place or another.
Excellent. I'm sorry.
There is one other thing. We do have this little side thing for TSL called The Four Winds, which is actually like a newspaper that takes place in the world of King's Quest. And as a prelude to episode 4, that's going to be starting to go back into print.
Yeah.
Going up on the internet
in the
next few weeks.
Yeah, I was going to mention that. I think, was it like the first hot air balloon ride?
Yes. There was a previous article that mentioned the Mount Go brothers and their hot air balloon tours.
Nice.
And you've continued that little side story in the latest issue.
So you guys write those on the side as well?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, we have a dedicated team now that's actually going to be working on that, so we're hoping to make it a more regular thing than we have in the past.
Oh,
and for those who are eager to know to get hints about what's going to be in episode 4, I'd say read those articles and,
yeah,
you know, you may be able to learn a couple of little things that will lead into the actual full story.
Accidental.
Yeah, and the Four Winds can easily be found on the game site, tsl-game.com.
Yep.
That's right.
Sezzy, the CEO of Phoenix Online Studios, anything you'd like to plug or promote or concluding thoughts?
Well, I mean, like I said, we do have a lot of exciting things coming on from Phoenix Online in the hopefully near future that we'll be able to start announcing what's going on, what we've been working in the past few months.
You know, in the meanwhile, get excited about episode 4 because it's gonna be a great episode, and it's gonna be the build up episode to the great epic finale that is episode 5, which Katie and we just finished working on the script for that, and it's gonna be a massive undertaking, but it's gonna be great, and it's gonna be a very fun episode to play. And you know, thank you to our fans for listening and for following us, for supporting us, for always being there for us. And thank you guys for the interview.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate all three of you guys coming on, Katie, Richard, and Sezzy. I'm glad I get to use your nickname. Like they just said, you guys can keep up with the four wins. Keep your eye out for episode 4, but you can also download, if you haven't even touched the game yet, you can download episode 1, 2, and 3 at tsl-game.com and find out more about Katie, Richard, and Cesar at postudios.com.
Thanks again, guys. The game is free, so...
Yes. The game is free, completely free.
Completely.
Fans made for a fan game. Again, I really appreciate you guys... Sezzy making the last noise. thanks again, guys.
Thank you very much.